I stand around here and listen to, okay? This concerns you and all you young people. All you here, I've taught how to defend yourself. What would you do if someone grabbed you?
Fight back.
Fight back, because why?
So you don't get stolen?
Yeah, it might be the last time that we ever see you. That's a reality in Indian country that's going on. If someone grabs you and you don't fight back, it might be the last time that you're alive.
It's been called an invisible epidemic. On reservations across North America, Native American women are going missing or being murdered in alarming numbers. Today, how the women of one reservation are learning to fight back, literally, at a boxing gym in Montana. Then, later in the show, former NFL offensive lineman Jeff Schwartz joins us to discuss his thoughts on anti-Semitism in the NFL. I'm Mina Kimes. It's Friday, July 10th. This is ESPN Daily. Hey, Kristen, thanks for coming on.
Hi, Mina. I'm glad to be here. Thank you for having me.
Kristen Lapis is a producer at ESPN and the director of the ESPN Films documentary, Blackfeet Boxing, Not Invisible. So this is a story a very long time in the making. You visited the Blackfeet Indian Reservation in Montana multiple times over many months to really focus on one tiny boxing gym. But backing out for those of us who have never been there, how would you describe the Blackfeet Reservation?
The best way to describe it is isolated. You fly into Great Falls, Montana, and then you drive 3 hours north. And right at the Canadian border is where the reservation sits. It borders along the lines of Glacier National Park. So it's a really beautiful part of our country. It's just a gorgeous, gorgeous landscape. The Blackfeet Reservation is actually larger than the state of Rhode Island. It's very, very vast. But what makes it so interesting is that it only has a population of 16,000 people. So it's a very tight-knit community that kind of sits on this huge, huge plot of land in, you know, Big Sky country.
What is life like for people in the community?
I think that overall, the tribe members are really proud of the reservation. They're proud of their land. But in reality, people don't have a ton of recreational escapes on the reservation, so that ends up leading to a lot of drug and alcohol abuse. There's a huge issue with addiction to methamphetamine on the reservation. There's almost this juxtaposition of the reservation and its beauty versus the harsh realities that exist on the reservation, because there's just not a lot to do, especially for the young people. There's no mall, there's no movie theater, no bowling alleys. All of the things that maybe you or I were used to doing in high school on a weekend night or a weekend day, they just don't have there. And I think it leads to a lot of problems on the reservation.
Of the many issues that the Native American community faces, the one that you highlight in your film is the growing number of missing and murdered Indigenous women, also known as MMIW. How would you describe the MMIW phenomena?
It's been described by a lot of the people that are familiar with the issue as a pandemic, as a crisis. It's a crisis that isn't talked about a lot, but it's a major issue.
They have been nameless and faceless for decades, until now.
Missing and murdered
Native American women.
Native American women in the United States are 10 times more likely to be murdered than the rest of the population.
In the last 4 years, over 5,000 girls and women have gone missing or been murdered, and their cases are still open. No one knows what's happened to them. According to the United States Justice Department, Native American women are 10 times more likely to be murdered than non-Native American women, and more than 1 in 3 has suffered rape or attempted rape in their lifetime. That right there just goes to show you how much abuse and violence this group of women experience in their lifetimes. It's tragic, and it's not just on the Blackfeet Reservation. It's on reservations all across the U.S. and in Canada as well.
Why do you think this problem persists?
Everybody that we talk to explained to us it's not just a clean cut one thing is causing this. It's a lot. And it starts with the history of what Native American, especially women, have experienced over the last, you know, hundreds of years. We interviewed a woman named Theda Newgrest, who is of Blackfeet descent, but she's also the founder of the Native Wellness Institute. She said it's very complicated. There isn't one reason why these girls and women are going missing from reservations.
I think it began with the Europeans that came. The stereotype of Pocahontas, the stereotype of Sacagawea, that we're disposable, that we don't count.
Being treated as second-class citizens, in media portrayals being seen as almost like sex symbols.
On film, when they first saw Native women, they didn't speak at all. They kind of just ugged around and pointed.
Drugs and alcohol on the reservations, human trafficking. It's not just one thing that we can say, okay, this is the reason why girls are going missing. It's all of the accumulation of a lot of issues, history that keeps repeating itself.
Kristen, you followed the case of one missing girl in particular, Ashley Loring Heavy Runner. What happened to her?
Ashley was a bright, bright student, was a three-sport athlete, lived on the Blackfeet Reservation, and was going to go to college at the University of Montana. And the summer after she graduated high school, she started to go down a darker path. She started hanging out with the wrong crowd, according to her sister.
She started to hang out with people involved with drug use, some people that were way older than us that just were not good people.
And then in June of 2017, Ashley disappeared.
She was last seen on Highway 89, right on the Rocky Mountains, on the Blackfeet Reservation. It's just like a panic because you don't know what's going on and you can't find her.
How did Ashley's disappearance affect the community?
You know, there's only 16,000 people in the community. So it touched every single member, but it especially affected the young girls on the reservation. We went to Browning High School to just, you know, get a sense of what the girls were feeling right after Ashley went missing. And the girls are terrified. Like, these aren't just statistics to them. This is a reality. These are girls that they know.
Like, she's really close to me, so it broke my heart when I found out that she was missing.
You know, these are girls that have, like, you know, their cases have not been dealt with at all.
Yeah, I felt scared because that could have been any one of us sitting at this table, any girl in Browning. And I felt like nobody was doing anything about it.
Ashley going missing just devastated these girls. A lot of the girls that we interviewed said that that was kind of the turning point for them, where they decided, I want to take matters into my own hands. I want to go and I want to learn self-defense tactics from the Blackfeet Nation Boxing Gym.
So tell me about this gym. Why was it initially created?
The Blackfeet Nation Boxing Club was founded by a gentleman named Frank Kipp, who was born and raised on the Blackfeet Reservation and was actually a former boxer. He was a really successful fighter in the welterweight division, and then in his adult life became a probations officer on the reservation. And it was there that he had this moment that he shares with us involving a little girl on the reservation that basically caused him to open the gym.
When I was a probation officer, I'll never forget one little girl that was raped and the guy beat her up and she had black eyes. I called up, the rape kit was lost. And they knew the name of the perpetrator, but it didn't happen, you know. And she said, don't worry, Frank. She said, it's going to be, I'm going to be okay. She said, it's because of who I am. She said, they won't, nothing will get done about it. And I was so mad because she was right. I started thinking, what can we do better, you know? How can we keep these girls from harm's way?
For Frank, that was kind of the moment where he was like, how can I do something about this? And that's when the gym came to fruition.
Jab, jab, jab. Throw your jab.
The gym trains both boys and girls. It's an outlet for kids to come to kind of escape the realities that they're facing at home. And it's 1,000% a place that girls come to learn how to protect themselves and to be empowered and gain the confidence to be able to fight back, both inside the ring and outside.
When you went there, did you see a lot of women?
Yes, it was amazing. There were probably 40 kids that showed up the first night that I was there. Half of them were young girls, as young as 6 years old. And, you know, some of them weren't, you know, hitting the heavy bags or sparring. Some of the girls were sitting in the corner with a coloring book, which I found to be so amazing because it was almost like they weren't just coming here for the boxing. They were coming to a safe place on the reservation where they felt like they could just be themselves and they could find an escape from maybe something going on at home. It was amazing. There were tons of young girls there and they were badasses.
All right, after the break, let's talk about one of the very talented young female fighters you met.
Vivid Seats wants to get you to the games you love this spring. Experience every pitch, assist, and game-winning shot live and in person. And the best part? Each transaction is a step toward a free 11th ticket with Vivid Seats rewards. Score unbeatable perks like free tickets, surprise seat upgrades, and annual birthday deals. As the official ticketing partner of ESPN, Vivid Seats is offering you $20 off your first $200 ticket purchase with code DAILY. That's code DAILY. Visit VividSeats.com or download the app today. Vivid Seats. Experience it live.
Kristen, at the Blackfeet Boxing Gym, how much of what Frank Kipp is teaching the girls is actual boxing technique as opposed to self-defense?
I think that Frank kind of tailors his training depending on who he's working with. With girls like his daughter, Donna Kipp, and Mimi Kennedy, who were both strong boxers, who had both qualified for the Junior Olympics in past years, you know, he's focusing on the actual boxing and technique with them. Whereas there are some girls there that might never, you know, have a future as a competitive boxer. But, you know, with them, he's teaching them things like if a guy, literally, he would say this, if a guy grabs you this way, this is how you get out of that hold. Or one girl told me that he taught her how to break somebody's arm. And I found that to be amazing because it's like you're teaching these young girls, you know, these tactics that don't necessarily work inside the ring, but they'll work out on the reservation. And I think that with every lesson in the gym, Frank kind of tells the girls, like, this is not just training for in here, it's training for out there.
Mamie Kennedy is one of the girls you focus on in your story. You mentioned she's a very good boxer. How good is she and who is she?
When we first showed up at the reservation, she was 13 years old and the year before had qualified for the Junior Olympic National Tournament. When we started filming, Frank told us that he thought she had Olympic potential and that he saw her placing and medaling in the Junior Olympics that summer. And what we came across was a young girl who was bright-eyed and she had this, it's hard to describe, but she had this innocence to her. She actually pulled me aside and talked to me about how her grandmother told her she needed to join the gym after Ashley disappeared.
My grandma was telling me, you gotta join boxing for self-defense. She didn't want me to go missing like Ashley. I said, yeah, I want to try it out.
Mamie is one of those kind of girls. She's as tough as boiled ale. You look at her eyes, you know that she's a fighter.
All the boys that I sparred, they all got scared. They all didn't want to spar me.
After spending some time with Mamie, I was like, we need to tell this girl's story.
So what happened to her?
So when we start filming these stories, Mina, obviously, as you know, we don't know what the final outcome is. You're told that she has Olympic potential and that she is a shoo-in at the Junior Olympic Nationals. And so you start following her and her story. And we went out there a few times and we filmed with her. We interviewed her. We shot her training in the gym. And then we got a call in late February of 2019. It was Frank, and he had told us that he could not find Mamie.
Just, she was gone. Worry about her? Of course I do. That girl has so much talent. If she was here, she would have had a wall full of trophies this year. And for Mamie, you know, I tell her, that door's always open.
She had quit the gym. She had dropped out of school. And he was really worried about her. When you work on these stories, you try to be, you know, an unbiased storyteller, but obviously you develop relationships with these people. And to know that she had disappeared and no one knew where she had gone really scared me, and it concerned me. We ended up finding her on the reservation in June of 2019 when we went back for one of our final shoots. And she had quit the gym. She had told us that she was starting to drink and do the things that she had told us in her initial interview that she wanted to avoid because they had ruined her family. And unfortunately, she had gone down the wrong path. One of the things that she told me in the final interview we did with her that really stuck with me is she said,
I was a fighter. Not anymore.
And it kind of almost applied to her life outside of the gym as well. It was just really, really sad.
How would you describe your life in the last 4 months?
Miserable. Yeah.
Why?
Because I drink and like I've been doing that and messing up and stuff.
People say Mamie has Olympic potential as a boxer. What do you think of that?
Kind of makes me want to get back at it again, but I don't know, I'm just not feeling it anymore.
Kristen, whatever happened with Ashley Loring, heavy runner?
Her family's still out there searching, Mina.
So let's spread out and go towards the trees.
It's 3 years since she last was seen, and her family still goes out on a weekly basis to search the reservation, calling her name, trying to find her.
They got a tip that there was bones down here. I think that she's out here somewhere.
Her legacy, though, is so much more than that. She's really become the face of this MMIW movement. Ashley represents change, hopefully, and is giving this community a voice finally and a platform to tell the world about this issue.
Was her family aware of the boxing gym?
Yes, they were. They all told me they wished that she had gone there, actually. They truly believe that if a girl knew some of these tactics and was trained in self-defense, that they might have been able to help themselves. if somebody were to come and approach them and try to take them, they would be able to defend themselves and protect themselves. And that was really cool to see the support that the family had for the gym and the work that Frank was doing, even though Ashley never made it to the gym.
Kristen, after all of your visits and all of the reporting you did, how important would you say the Blackfeet Boxing Gym is to that community and that reservation?
Oh, it's one of the few bright lights on the reservation. Everybody that we talked to on the res knew Frank Kipp and commended him for the work that he's done. Mina, when we first went to the reservation, there was a little bit of skepticism from the community about us filming there, because I feel like a lot of people that had come in the past with cameras had only shown the negative aspects of their community, and they hadn't focused on any of the positive things that people were doing to try to combat these issues. And we had to try to convince them that that's exactly what we wanted to do. We wanted to focus on the one place that girls could come to be empowered. In talking with Donna and Frank now, the gym, because of COVID-19, had to shut down in early March, and it hasn't been allowed to reopen. And that really concerned Frank, because it's one of the few escapes, like I said, on the reservation where kids can come. And he's really concerned that they don't have that place to go right now. But he's hopeful that, you know, in the coming months, they'll be able to reopen their doors and hopefully help a lot of young people, especially the young girls.
Thanks so much, Kristen.
Thank you, Mina.
A short postscript for this story. In October, Mamie Kennedy returned to the Blackfeet Boxing Gym. Frank is hopeful she will continue to box. And Frank's daughter, Donna, says she plans to continue operating the gym once he retires. You can catch Blackfeet Boxing Not Invisible on Sunday at 3:30 p.m. on ABC, or streaming now on ESPN.com and the ESPN app. Coming up, former NFL offensive lineman Jeff Schwartz on anti-Semitism in football and beyond.
When you're on a business trip, you know what completely goes off the rails? Your workout routine, especially when you book a hotel that doesn't have a gym. So what ends up happening is you do a few push-ups and sit-ups in your room, run around the block, or just skip it entirely. Lame. If you just stay at La Quinta by Wyndham, you'll discover there's a fully equipped fitness center at every location. Now you can wake up and power your buys and tries the right way, or de-stress with some cardio. The choice is yours. Tonight, La Quinta. Tomorrow, you shine. Book direct at LQ.com.
Here's another story I want you to know. Last weekend, Philadelphia Eagles wide receiver DeSean Jackson posted anti-Semitic rhetoric on his Instagram page, leading both the team and the NFL to condemn his posts. While many of Jackson's teammates have been silent on the issue, some NFL players, like Julian Edelman, appealed to him via social media.
I've seen DeSean play in his career, make outstanding football plays. We've communicated over social media. I've got nothing but respect for his game. I know he said some ugly things, but I do see an opportunity to have a conversation.
Earlier this week, former NFL offensive lineman Jeff Schwartz, who is Jewish, responded to the posts in a video posted on Twitter.
So look, we know DeSean Jackson's post was inappropriate. To me, the biggest issue is that he doesn't really realize it's anti-Semitic. And I think for so long, Jewish people have been getting on, for lack of a better term, for thousands of years, that just kind of, when these things happen, there's just not as much outrage.
Jeff, who is also an NFL analyst and host of the podcast Jeff Schwartz is Smarter Than You, shared a few instances of anti-Semitism that he had experienced when he was in the league and described what his faith means to him. So I wanted him to come on the show and discuss why he was moved to speak out and what he thinks can be learned from the incident. Jeff, how's it going?
Good. How you doing? I think we're I didn't expect to talk about this week, put it like that.
Yeah, I don't think any of us did. And it's been a couple days now, but I want to go back to when this post first happened, I suppose, and ask just when you saw it and what your initial reaction was to it.
My first thought wasn't immediately like Deshaun Jackson is a huge anti-Semitic person. My first thought was kind of he might not know any better. A lot of players don't know what anti-Semitism is. A lot of them don't understand Judaism very well.
What made you decide to post about it?
Well, no one was saying anything, which I thought was odd, kind of in the time we are on social media where everyone has an opinion on everything. I found it odd that no one was talking about this. And I felt it was important to share my experiences in an NFL locker room. You know, I get asked by a lot of Jewish people to talk about my time in the NFL. I get asked a lot about anti-Semitism that may or may not have happened to me in the NFL. And I found it so fascinating hearing from players about their religion, what they believe, and what I believe. And I think you grow as a person the more curious you are. I had no problem talking to my teammates about race, religion, politics, and I might be on the unique side of that. So that's why I felt it was necessary for me to put out a long video about my experiences.
For those who don't know, how common is it for there to be a Jewish player on a team?
I mean, when I was in the NFL, there were, I don't know, five, six maybe. There's three now. My brother, Ali Marpet, not many guys. You might be with someone who's Jewish, but they don't feel comfortable discussing religion. But the locker room is a very religious place. It's hard to ignore religion, right? The Lord's Prayer is said before and after every game. There's players' prayer sessions in the locker room before games. There's Bible study in the facility at times or at someone's house. Like, it's hard to ignore that religion is part of a locker room.
So is it safe to say most of your teammates had never been to a bar mitzvah?
They never even met a Jewish person. I got that a lot. You're the first Jewish person I've met. You know, when you have a locker room that's really no Jews in it, it's hard to make a connection with Judaism. When it comes to Black Lives Matter and social justice causes, it's very easy to see your teammate who is very, you know, very impacted by these movements and by what's happening in our country. So it's very easy to understand that person and what they're feeling and to support them, right? You're in the locker room, you can visibly see their anger, their grief, and it's easy to relate to that and easy to back up your teammate. There's just not a lot of players in the NFL that are Jewish. So it's hard, in my opinion, for a player who's never really talked to a Jewish person, who doesn't understand Judaism, who doesn't understand anti-Semitism, to say, hey, this is not good. This is not, you know, I'm not putting up with this.
Do you think that was the case with Deshaun Jackson, just ignorance?
I hope so. His explanation for what he was trying to get across wasn't remotely close to what he posted. So I don't know what the disconnect is there. I mean, you know, His apology mentioned, you know, it was more of a black empowerment type quote, but that wasn't at all what it said. But I will give Deshaun the benefit of the doubt. I know some people will not. He has, you know, talked to his owner, talked to general manager. He has, or they've announced that he's going to meet with a rabbi, and hopefully he takes Julian Edelman up on his offer to go to the Holocaust Museum.
So to that end, Deshaun, let's do a deal. How about we go to D.C., and I take you to the Holocaust Museum. And then you take me to the Museum of African American History and Culture. Afterwards, we grab some burgers and we have those uncomfortable conversations.
Your life is forever changed going to that. It's very heavy. It's very emotional. If you're not changed after going to that museum, you'll never be. So I'll give him the benefit of the doubt.
It sounds like you believe, you know, education is the most important step in fixing some of the problems we've discussed. And that's why Julian Edelman reached out to Deshaun, and hopefully some of the steps you described will be taken. What more do you think the NFL, its players, and even people like you can do to combat anti-Semitism?
I think awareness is the way to do it. I think that people do not understand what anti-Semitism is. You know, this is something that I'm not going to speak for all Jews, but I see people talking a lot about, you know, race. It comes to there is no Jewish race. We are a religion. We are people of all colors. The idea that, you know, that would be a first step in understanding what anti-Semitism is. So it's just, I think it starts from there. It's understanding, you know, more about Judaism, what anti-Semitism is.
Thanks so much, Jeff. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
I'm Mina Kimes, and this has been ESPN Daily. Our show is produced by Alexander Hyacinth, Mike Johns, Steve Martin, Ryan Nantel, Andy Tennant, Eve Tro, Chris Tuminello, and Aaron Vail. Special thanks this week to Russell DiNallo, Troy Farkas, and Pablo Torre. I'll talk to you Monday.